This is a production of Cornell University.
Welcome to the show. We have a really interesting conversation today about something that's literally taken, you know, no commercial people want to admit it, but commercial people make up less than 15% of all the money spent in the turf grass industry. You're talking about homeowners, and maybe they're spending it on commercial services for a little bit more. But the home lawn market drives the majority of how we value the turf grass industry. So we're going to talk a little bit about home lawn stuff today. But we have some guests, like I usually like to talk about. Mike Fidanza's dog, a previous guest on the show, is doing well, sitting on a chair. And here's Ralphie and Leo from the Chicago District Golf Association's Derek Settle, who goes out on field tours with these two knuckleheads. And then another passing Ryan Gordon at the course at Snoqualmie Ridge up in Seattle. He posted about his dog he lost. This is, again, just connecting. I just love this dog thing that we've got going. And also, the pet population has gone up about 20 to 25%. Which is a big part of the long conversation. So let me do the weather, Carl, quick, and then I'm going to set you guys up and get out of the way. Things are warming up quick. We have really seen a rapid push in warm-up. So if you're making sprays for root pathogens like fairy ring or drenches for summer patch, you're going to be making those applications relatively quickly in the New York metropolitan area. And all the way up the Hudson Valley and even stretching into here into central New York. It was a dry week last week. And in fact, I think we had the first period of time, our climatologist told us that we were drying more than we had rainfall for maybe the first time this season. And you can see the rainfall percentages are generally 100% or more of normal, with a few dry patches smattered throughout the region, Cape Cod, right around New York City, where you're just a little bit short of normal just for the month of April, which has just gotten started. What generally this means is growth is unabated. what they sometimes say is, listen, if your grass doesn't look good this time of year, maybe you should find another line of work. Because it's pretty good, easy to grow grass. In fact, it grows, you can't stop it. I think, Carl, you mentioned, you could mow multiple times in a week. I mow an area for my wife out at the house. I mowed it on Sunday and it needed to be mowed yesterday on Wednesday. So we know growth is crazy. But at the same time, our little pollinator risk tool, Carl, is really starting to show up what we're seeing across the state with regard to dandelion flowering, right? This is Sarah. This is a tool that Carl's developed that's looking at dandelion and clover blooming in the lawn to try to help those people who might be making applications to their lawns to maybe recognize that there's risk and potential pollinators visiting it. So we are with Dr. Sarah Stricker. Sarah is the outreach coordinator from the Guelph Turfgrass Institute, one of the great turfgrass programs in the world for many years, and that's widely respected throughout the world and, of course, is the source of information in Canada. And Sarah's been very outspoken. I love this, Sarah. We talked about this on my other podcast. I think you guys have done just a great job in getting out into the media and being thoughtful about this. I think your most recent communication efforts on Twitter with lawn science and just trying to teach people about how lawns work, what's going on there, citing the science about these things. I just, this is exactly, we don't want to be defensive, even though we're like, yeah, I don't think this is a good idea. But at the same time, you want to sort of embrace the idea that we're thinking about lawns differently. Carl, and as I get you in here, you sent around this iNaturalist conversation about this whole no mow May thing happening among eco people. And I can tell you they're much more polite than the general public in social media. So big shout out to iNaturalist forum contributors. It's the first time I've ever heard bee washing. So look at this. Oh yeah, you can't fix lawns. No mow May is a band-aid when lawns need a tourniquet. This is just bee washing. I just love this, Carl. So there you go, brother.
Yeah, so I think before we get Sarah in here, just sort of setting up the No Mo May conversation, right, Frank? So it's May 2nd, and I'll show some data here in a bit on Google searches and how people start searching for No Mo May now instead of in April, which is a little bit weird. But basically, the idea is relatively new. I didn't realize it was so new. I guess 2019 over in Britain, UK organization Plant Life started promoting it as a way to promote pollinators in the lawn. So basically, the idea is you treat your lawn like a lawn every single month of the year, except for May, in which you just let it grow. And the idea is that there will be flowering plants that'll grow up as you don't mow. And that can be a pollinator sort of foraging resource for them early in the season, especially when there's not a whole lot around. If you look through some literature, this is the thing that sort of pops up when you search it. A paper out of Appleton, Wisconsin, and they said that, hey, we found no-mow May lawns relative to traditional lawns have higher pollinator richness and abundance. So the idea was they sort of survey pollinators and, oh, wow, we got more in the no-mow May lawn. This sort of supports the idea that it's good for pollinators. And then you started to see certain municipalities, Appleton, Wisconsin, some places in Minnesota. Around here, Frank, we're starting to hear chatter, especially when it comes to code of cities and towns where normally you're supposed to keep vegetation, lawn type vegetation under 8 inches. And they're saying, eh, we'll make an exemption for no mow May because it's good for pollinators. The problem with that is that that paper was retracted a couple years ago. And an entomologist detailed sort of a lot of reasons why the paper had some inconsistencies. First of all, how they were identifying bees by sight and not with a microscope, which you would need to identify the certain species of bees, and also that they were reporting bees that just didn't exist in Wisconsin during May. And then there's some other landscape context things, reasons why that the paper probably wasn't so good. And it turns out when you look at some different papers that haven't been retracted, you actually see these sort of bee abundances, how many bees are going on the lawn. When you can cut the lawn every 2 weeks, even in May, you have more bees than a 3 week mowing interval. And there's some evidence there that, hey, you sort of got to cut the grass so that it doesn't sort of shade out the dandelion flowers or the clover flowers so the bees can actually see them. And actually, Sean Askew's got a graduate student, Frank, who's looking at UV light, sort of how pollinators see. And if you have a no-mow May lawn, which has really long grass, that basically obscures the ability for the bees to see those foraging resources. So, hey, maybe that's actually preventing them from getting to the flowers, right? And this is just some evidence from some pictures from my community where I see a couple of no-mow May lawns, and it really just doesn't go well at the end of it, right? So the end, you got to cut that grass down, right? That's the idea of in June and July, you're going to treat it like a lawn, and that seems to have some bad consequences that I've seen. Handling that vegetative material, right? Where do you put all those clippings, which have nitrogen and phosphorus in them? How do you dispose of those off the lawn? Some damage to long-term turf quality. We'll ask Sarah, actually, so you've got some research there from a no-mow May plot last year. You can maybe share with us. And then this idea of the other animals that sort of inhabit that long vegetation throughout May. If you've got some small mammals, some snakes, and then you sort of cut all that down, they were setting up shop all spring, and then you just shock in one shock event disrupted that entire habitat. So maybe that's not such a good thing. We're focused on pollinators. That might not be good. So this is a perfect time to talk about no-mow May. When I look at Google Trends the last 5 years in New York, no-mow May, you see that first spike in 2021, more interest in 2022, and even more interest last year. We'll see what we do this year. But interesting to me, Frank, that the searches peak in the second week of May, which if I were going to implement No Mow May, I'd probably want to know before May 1st that I was going to do it, not sort of like, well, we're 2 weeks into May. Should I mow my lawn? Oh, maybe I don't need to mow my lawn. So this starts to bring in some questions. Who are we dealing with? I guess, the audience of No Mow May? And this is what Sarah's work and everybody at Guelph Turfgrass Institute has some really good resources now. No to Mow May. This is a website. You guys have set up a lot of cool, good visuals. So good sort of snippet posters you can send people to get some just really basic information on what's good for pollinators. Is the stuff in lawns good for pollinators? How should I treat my lawn if I want that? And then really good communication of the literature too. So you have these papers and you sort of bring out the notes that are key for people to know. A really good way to communicate sort of the primary source literature to average people who are going to start maybe implementing this. So that starts to get us to our questions, right, Frank? And I
There
think
we
the
go.
first question, Sarah, is Who is the audience, right? And we always, as extension people, start with like, who are we trying to communicate with? I guess in your sort of experience with people who are looking at Nomome, is there a general profile of people who want to do this or groups who want to adopt this practice?
You've got a lot of background on this, and I totally support this. Before I get in this, I did when you pulled up the paper about the Del Toro paper with the beast, they are going to republish it. They did do some restudy, so there is a paper that has been pre-published and it's available online now, and so they basically redid it. But not only was the issue that they were identifying bees incorrectly, they were comparing no-mow lawns to mowed parks, which are totally different environments. Mowed lawns, well, even mowed lawns are going to have more pollinators than a park because there's generally flowers around a lawn, right? So anyways, that's one little caveat. But what I'm finding with Nomome is it's mostly homeowners and it's people who want to do good things. And probably the spike in that 2 week part is because that they're seeing other people who have put the Nomome signs out. And so they're on their smartphones on the walk and their dog, be like, what does this mean actually? And some people get really upset about it. There's actually a paper in the Wall Street Journal that people were citing each other's neighbors and calling in, and people get really upset because you say that you're making your neighborhood look messy or bringing down the property value or whatever. So it's generally homeowners, but because there has been this big virality of it on social media and such. And then last year, I think also we were talking to a lot of news media outlets that also could have contributed a bit to the spike. So that has developed policies in certain municipalities. They've had to set a rule on it. And once the municipality sets a rule, then people are going to start to Google it. But it's homeowners, really. And really, it's people who want to do a good thing, right? They're just
Well, let
misinformed.
me
It's
wait, wait, Sarah. Wait, Sarah. We talk about people arguing in virality. That's normal business in New York State. So, I asked a question this morning of somebody. I'm going to ask it of you. Can you separate out people trying to do good from people who just hate lawns?
No, I the people who hate lawns hate them because they want to see more biodiversity. I think anyone you stop on the street and ask them, is biodiversity a good thing? They'll agree with you, right? Because that's what we've all been taught, right? But the people who hate lawns, they're not really understanding the functional space that it is. And that's part of the website that I have that's Lawn Science that also talks about what are the functions of lawns. And it would be lovely in a world that we could just say, yeah, everybody's lawn can convert to a wildflower meadow. But then don't call me when your cat goes missing because now you have coyotes. Right? Like there are pest control elements. Like, yes, there are studies that fleas and ticks are not really that much more in long grass unless you live next to forests. Okay, so if you live next to forests, you're going to have more fleas and ticks. And also, if we're building multiple neighborhood corridors of everyone doing long grass, then that's going to create more larger animals like deer, and deer carry ticks, and then you're gonna have ticks, right? So like the studies that exist that say, oh no, long grass doesn't actually carry ticks, they're small studies, right? They're small plot studies and they cannot be applied to how, like it's common sense to say you're gonna find more ticks in long grass. The Guelph Turfgrass Institute actually just, we moved only about 500 meters, half a kilometer, and our old location, we stopped mowing it for 4 months, and if you walked in there with white pants, you'd come out with black pants because of how much ticks you had, and there's no forest there, right? So, anyways, there's also a town in Ontario that they had a really great initiative, and it's a good feel-good movement where they said that they were going to completely naturalize, I think it was like 20% of the landmass of their public parks. They just said they're going to naturalize them. 12 months, no cut. Well, now, this year, they had to add $3,000 back into their budget to mow those all down because they have rats. Right? So it's tough.
Well,
You have
we
the
can
good idea,
agree. Yeah, we
and
can agree
then.
rats and snakes and coyotes don't belong in lawns, Carl, but what about pollinators?
Right. And so that's the next question. I think, Sarah, you're bringing up a lot of great sort of risks of no-mow May, and it's often billed as this is great for pollinators, and that's one potential function or ecosystem service of lawns. But there's other things that lawns are good for, and it's not just recreation, it's not just aesthetics, but things like stormwater controls, soil erosion, right, air temperature reduction. And if you're going to do no-mow May, maybe there's some health and safety risks. And just talking to some extension folks this morning, downstate in New York, they were saying that can be something that moves people off of no-mow May. When you talk about ticks, when you talk about snakes or mice that can get near foundations, then it all of a sudden is, ooh, you know, is it worth me having pollinators in the lawn for that? And I guess the next question is, does this really, you know, should we be promoting pollinators in the lawns? Are there things like dandelion or clover or self-heal? I guess how good are those for pollinators? And is it worth sort of sacrificing some of our other functions or ecosystem services of the lawn to get those foraging sort of edibles for pollinators in the lawn?
Yeah, well, and we talk about the obvious pests of the rats and the snakes and stuff. What about bees? Bee stings. There are people who are literally deathly allergic to bees. So I don't know, if you were to go back 30 years and say, oh, how much I love bees, people would look at you like, what? Because it was before the popularization of the EpiPen. Right? So I personally don't want bees in my backyard because I like to play with my dog and walk barefoot in my grass. So no thank you. I don't want bees there. But pollinators are not just bees either. There are in bees alone, there's hundreds of species of bees. Then there's also moths and birds and flies, right? So if you're going to say you're going to support all of these hundreds, possibly thousands of pollinator species that exist with one flower, a dandelion, which is A, not native, and B, not a very good nutrition source, that doesn't seem right to me, right? It's the band-aid when you need a tourniquet. You don't need dandelions, you need apple species, you need the flowering dogwoods, you need the magnolias, you need the willow species, you need all of these things. Like if I were to have let's say a wedding and I'm having 100 people over, I'm not just going to put out one bowl of chips, right? I'm going to put out a buffet because I know that not everybody is going to like my favorite flavor of dill pickle chips. Some people won't eat it and some people will be allergic, right?
And
Oh,
now we're somewhere else. Listen, here's something that I hear often, and it was reiterated in the iNaturalist thing, Sarah. I know you guys have been playing around with this, and I think maybe even measuring pollinators. Correct me if I'm wrong there, but one of the things I hear is when people want to help pollinators, they buy plants in the spring and then they help the pollinators in the summer and the fall. Or they buy plants in the summer and they help them in the fall. Or they buy them in the fall and maybe they'll come up in the spring, but tend to come up in the fall. Is the lawn, from your perspective, actually potentially useful for early spring visitors, early spring natives, specialists? And would you say that it's probably best to delay mowing rather than to necessarily, or if you mow, as the study showed, relax it a little bit. But these spring ephemerals, I'm wondering, it can serve a real purpose, but it's sort of misaligned in timing, at least in my mind. And it seems like it's become something mostly because of the alliteration. You know, like, you know, mo no shave November, or, you know, I think it took off on men not shaving in November, and men are lawn people. And so now it's no mow May because they don't shave in November and they don't want to cut their grass in May. It could be a rebellion of the entire male species. Who knows, Sarah? But can you talk a little bit about early spring stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. So in my neighborhood, at least, the crocuses have already come and gone. So I strongly believe, at least in my ecosystem, and I cannot say a blanket statement through across all of North America, plant crocuses in your lawn to provide early spring pollen, because I don't know when the crocuses will pop in your neighborhood versus my neighborhood. But for Ontario, Southern Ontario specifically, you can incorporate crocuses or snowdrops into a lawn, and they will flower and complete their entire life cycle before you even need to mow, and that's usually in April. You can also incorporate white clover and seed that, interseed that. White clover actually works pretty well with lawn grasses and can be mowed, and the more you mow it, the smaller the plants can get, but they're not actually really spring flowers, they're actually late summer flowers. So you could have crocuses for the spring and clover for later. And the other things that you mentioned, self-heal, and you can also incorporate wild strawberry, a lot of these different species, they can be incorporated into a lawn. You might have to raise the height of cut and maybe cut less frequently. And also note that you'll have to change your use habits of that space as well, because they're not gonna be as traffic tolerant, right? You're not gonna see crocuses and self-heal and clover surviving very well in, let's say, a commonly used soccer field, right? We just don't see those. We see dandelions because they are able to handle high traffic and compacted soils, right? Yeah. So yes, you can incorporate and then call that like your B lawn. So yeah. I would say I could do that to my front lawn, and then I'll leave my back lawn as grass so that I can still enjoy that with my dog and my kids, right?
Yeah. So what do you think, Sarah, of those B mixes? I know Minnesota a couple years ago, I think had a mix there, and it has the things like white clover or self-heal. Have you tried those out? And that seems to me like, you know, at least in my lawn, and a lot of people's lawns, they have high traffic areas or high visibility areas and then peripheral areas. And if I can just take an area, maybe plant some of those mixes, maybe I mow it once a month or something.
Yeah.
That's a great idea, right? And so I guess, have you seen the efficacy of those mixes? Do they perform well? And is that the alternative that people should be looking at, as opposed to just letting their lawn grow in May and chopping it back down?
Yeah, we haven't seen any studies, or I haven't done any studies on it, but I've seen just colloquially in my own neighborhood, I've seen a bunch of people have high success with these things. But in general, I would think that some of these lawns, you just need to pay a little bit more attention to them. It's not as sort of automatic, like I'll cut my grass when I want to, you know, whatever. It's you know, lawn maintenance is, in my opinion, the easiest, least work for a homeowner, right?
There you go.
Whereas a bee mix, you're probably going to have to reseed that multiple times, because flowers and flowering plants just generally don't really like to be cut, even if they're mowing tolerant. Like, you're going to have to come back every 3 years or something and add some more seed back into that. You're going to have to be cognizant of, like you said, high traffic areas. It's not going to be completely flower meadow in the backyard. If you have a pathway that you're going back and forth to your shed, that's not going to have flowers in it, right? So just understanding and modifying your expectations of your bee lawn, it's not going to perform the same way as a grass lawn, and you're probably going to have to be a little bit more aware of the growth rates. Because if you do let the like, even micro clover, we have a plot back here and we didn't mow it, the micro clover turned into macro clover if you don't mow it. And then if you mow that down, it still applies to the 1/3 rule, right?
Yeah,
it's going to
yeah.
be really shocking to that plant, and even more so than a grass. So you have to, you can just put it on a calendar and say, oh, I'm just going to mow every 3 weeks or something. Well, if you have, like you showed in the beginning of this, that extreme flush of growth, you're going to have to be mowing it every week for that month, right? Just in general, the whole no mow May and the hashtag and the cuteness, we as turf managers, and you talk to any farmer also, you can't do anything on a calendar, because the weather changes year to year, climate is changing, and also ecosystems are totally different. I could do no mow May in Northern Ontario where the polar bears live.
Yeah.
Right? I could do no mow all summer.
Or maybe in Britain, and maybe that's why it worked in the UK, right? You know, maybe they have a cooler May. And for us, maybe shifting, like you said, shifting the timing, Frank, hey, no mow April. Like, My first mow this year in Ithaca, New York was April 28th, right? So I can get away, and just by the nature of how the grass grows without mowing in April. So Sarah, you've mentioned a couple alternatives here. We're talking about the bee lawn. Okay, maybe that's an alternative, but it's not quite as minimal, no maintenance as we might think. But you mentioned earlier just planting other trees and shrubs in the landscape. Is that the best way? Are those the I guess the most nutritious sources for pollinators early in the year? Is that sort of the best way to give them resources, maybe beyond, looking in the lawn for those resources?
Well, it's essentially don't do a pop-up shop for 4 weeks. Plan for the entire growing season. If you can think of or visit your local nursery and say, what flowers in May, what flowers in June, July, August, and plan for that. If you only have a small space, just even a hanging basket, a flower basket hanging off of your porch, that's providing pollen resources that would otherwise not be there. You can start small. Even in my backyard, I actually started a little naturalized area where I built a little fence, and it's about 2 meters squared that my dog won't go into, and I'm not going to mow it. I'm not going to cut it. I throw a random packet of wildflower seeds at it once in a while, and I don't manage that at all, because actually removing garden residues, like those hollow stems that come out of like sunflowers and stuff, those are valuable nesting materials for bees. And sometimes our best intentions are saying, yeah, let's provide pollinator support. We don't also provide pollinator habitat. I like to say that the number one hit to the carpenter bee was the invention of the gas furnace, because we no longer have wood piles, right? So the carpenter bee likes to live in wood piles. So even just having 3 or 4 logs in your backyard that you just leave alone, that's an amazing habitat for snakes and pollinators. And you could just leave that in that space, make sure that it's an area that is safe from your kids and your pets and everything else. And you're supporting biodiversity, right? Start small.
And Carl, you gotta love this show. 1 week we're talking about killing grass with salts, and now we're talking about snakes and rats and carpenter bees, because the landscapes that we manage are enormously complex. And one of the things, Sarah, that they involve, and you've touched on it a few times and made the comment, and I just want to reiterate it and get more thoughts on it. When you decide to have something that's going to look at your lawn as a different function than traditional, which is mostly you're looking at it and you run around your pets and your kids and you have lawn parties and you walk on it and it's all those things. So once you make the decision to help, and use this ecosystem service, enhance pollinators, you lose some of the cultural stuff because you can't use that space for the things you used to use it for. And I'm not even talking about health reasons. No one wants to walk through 8-inch grass. You're not having a garden party with everybody standing around in knee-high grass. So when we're talking about importing these, trying to create some native or some habitat or viewing these things differently in the urban environment, ultimately it's going to change the way you're going to be able to use that area. Now, when you've played around with this a little bit, you've mentioned a bunch of plants. There are plenty of plants that will be low growing that you could mow at 3 inches or 4 inches, have a lawn that you can walk on and do everything else on, but also has these, incidental flowering plants, as we like to call them. So talk a little bit more about when people talk to you about this, you actually say, I'm sure you say to them, listen, you can't have a garden party in this thing. When you stop mowing it and make it a bee lawn.
The whole backyard wedding industry will shut down if everybody has a bee lawn, right? Lawns have functions, right? You said backyard barbecues, social events, even just me being able to hang my laundry in the backyard, I need to be able to walk on the grass to be able to pin my laundry to my line, right? So understanding that maybe when you drive past my lawn and I'm not physically out there, that on that moment, it looks like my lawn is a useless space, but actually it is doing a lot of functions even when no one's physically walking on it, right? It's holding that soil down. It's allowing water to percolate back down in to refill our ground aquifers, which are our drinking system. They act as a natural filtration system. And you know what? People don't think about this often, but it's also temporary parking sometimes. I know most people in the winter will park on their lawns. We have it all the time here when we have field days. We park on the grass, mm-hmm. right? There's so many functions that you don't think of. And if I had a garden, this entire backyard, I wouldn't be able to do those things when I want to use them, even if I'm not using them all the time. Grass is sort of the holding space for future yeah. events, right?
And the simplest and easiest, your point about being simple and easy is well taken. And Carl, do we have a question? Because we're at the fastest 30-minute hour here.
We're right at the end. Just a couple, I think, concepts. Rich was talking about bees and pesticide use and how that interacts with flowers. And I think, Frank, what we're starting to think about and maybe promote is the idea that if you're going to have pollinators in your lawn, if you're going to have some incidental flowering plants, the clovers, the self-heals, you probably shouldn't apply insecticide applications. Yeah. We would say in one of the BMPs is to mow flowers off before you make those applications. And we're finding with clover, you can run that mower over at 2.5 inches, Hayden Box data up in Geneva. There's still 50% of clover flowers that didn't get cut, right? So.
Oh, and dandelion flowers duck too.
Yep.
I've seen them go, they
They duck.
Back up.
Yeah, like well, they're an inch and a half off the ground, right? So sort of, you know, aligning your pesticide use, your IPM strategies with the functions of the lawn, I think is one of the big keys we're taking away from today. So,
Sarah, thanks for joining us. Carl, great job on this. And everybody, appreciate you joining us for the fastest 30 minutes in turf. We'll see you here. Oh, one programming note. We will not be here next Thursday at 10 a.m. Eastern time because my last kid is graduating college. So I will be standing there in tears as I'm enjoying of happiness with the last tuition bill I paid. So for all of you, Sarah, thanks for taking the time. Carl, take it easy. We'll talk to you guys again.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks a bunch, Sarah. Appreciate it.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.